Committee to order. It is about 5 after 10 on Saturday, April 2nd. Prisoner Representative Elkin, Representative Lynn, Representative Gardner, myself, Chair Seaton. At this time, everybody remember their cell phones, turn them off. Today, we're going to take House Bill 133 first, and then we will work on considerations of the retirement system. We will be working predominantly from now on with House Bill 238, the State Affairs Bill, and we have a presentation today on the proposed medical program, and you'll have a handout on that.
Mr. Chairman, before we start, I'd like to recognize and thank the chairman and vice chairman of the Boundary Commission for the emails that they sent us, and they're in the packet, but they were helpful.
Okay, very good. And so we will have that will be our order of business today, and we will have a presentation at some time with the Division of Retirement Benefits on the medical plan, and they're conflicted between us and another hearing that is going on at the same time considering these same subjects. So there are people running back and forth. So without anything else, Representative Lynn, would you move the bill, the CRA version, before the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I would move CS for sponsored substitute for House Bill number 133, CRA, that's 24-LS0512/F.
For discussion.
For discussion.
Thank you.
One.
And we have Representative Coghill is the sponsor of this, and we have his staff person here to present the bill to us. Reneva, would you identify yourself? And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Reneva Moss, legislative aide for Representative Coghill. Sponsor substitute for House Bill 133 is the product of something that was brought to our attention early in session concerning the Fairbanks area and the plans to use a regulation that would allow for an aggregate vote to annex land into the Fairbanks North Star Borough. Under state law, in order for an area to be annexed, it has to be approved by a majority of the people who vote in the area that's being annexed. This aggregate regulation undermines that intention. What it says is that the people within the existing borough and the people who live in an area to be annexed would all vote on the annexation, and all of the votes would be pulled together, and if a majority of that aggregate vote approves, then the area is annexed. And Representative Coghill feels very strongly that that is not legislative intent. It was not intent of the Constitutional Convention, and piece of legislation says that regulations that are adopted by the local boundary commission have to be consistent with state statute. The commission has in the past said that they felt the Constitution gave them separate authority from the legislature to do as they want, but that is not Representative Coghill's contention, and we do have former Lieutenant Governor Jack Coghill online to testify as far as his understanding of intent. This piece of legislation also does a couple of other things. At the request of the speaker, we added language in CRA that would be section one of the CRA version, which says that the local boundary commission cannot amend or a petition, and it cannot impose other conditions that are not on the petition. So it's an either-or situation. The Constitution says they may consider petitions, but it doesn't give them the authority to amend petitions or impose additional conditions on the incorporation. The second area that was added to the piece of legislation in CRA is Section 2. And excuse me, this wasn't added in CRA, it was added in the sponsor substitute. This says that even if the local boundary commission wants to bring a proposal for incorporation to the legislature, there still has to be two public hearings, and there has to be an election of the people. Representative Coghill does have one amendment that he would like for the committee to consider. Do all of you have the amendment?
Yes, we do. It should be in the front of everyone's packet.
What this does is it brings annexation in line with...
Just a moment. Let me make sure everyone does. Yes, they do. Go ahead.
This brings annexation in line with how service areas are formed. When a service area is formed, there is an election of the people in the existing, or excuse me, when a service area is altered, an area is annexed in. The people in the service area have an election, and the people in the proposed annexed area have an election. Both elections are separate. Both require a majority vote of the people. So it has to be approved by a majority of the people in the existing service area and in the proposed annexed area. This amendment would make it so that any annexations that occur in a municipality would require that same vote, a vote of the people in the existing municipality and a vote of the people in the area to be annexed. This does two things. It allows people in an area to be annexed to have a voice as to whether or not they're going to be in a new municipality, but it also avoids what could be termed as a hostile takeover, where an area wants to be annexed that is larger than the area that is already a municipality. An example would be a municipality, a borough that has 1,000 registered voters, and an area remote from that place that happens to be an unorganized area that has 2,000 registered voters. They would be able to possibly take over that existing municipality because they're outnumbering the existing municipality by 2-1. So Representative Coghill would like you to consider amending the bill to add that language into it.
Thank you. And I'm just looking at the amendment on line 11. It says a proposed annexation must be approved by the majority of votes on the question cast by voters residing in the annexing municipality. So this is where you're saying it establishes a separate vote for the municipality, and then the proposed vote in the area being annexed. Where is that?
That is, Mr. Chairman, that is the new subsection 2, which used to be subsection 1. It must be approved by a majority of votes on the question by voters residing in the area proposed to be annexed or detached.
Well, I'll move that amendment.
If you, let's see, we have before us. Let's, before we move the amendment, let's go ahead and take a public testimony. So we have a little broader basis. Yes, are there any questions for the sponsor or his representative? I understand the sponsor is online. And Representative Coghill, can you hear us?
Mr. Chairman, yes. To clarify that, it is former Lieutenant Governor Jack Coghill, who was a member of the Constitutional Convention. Representative Coghill is at the Governor's Prayer Breakfast.
Oh, okay. Thank you. We'll wait until we have public testimony, Representative Coghill. Representative Elkins.
Well, I just had a quick question, and I think I know the answer, but this deals only with annexation, not unification or consolidation.
Through the chair, Representative Elkins, this says proposed annexation.
Yeah, I just wanted to be sure.
Are there any other questions for the sponsor on 133? Thank you, Reneva. We'll take public testimony, but if you would be able to wait, we'd appreciate that. We have a fair amount of public testimony on this. We don't have a long period of time today, so I ask everyone to please keep their testimony short, and if someone else has covered the information that you have, would you just, or the same opinion, would you please indicate that you agree with the opinion of the and go on from there. So we'll start in Delta Junction. Mary Gravan?
Not really. Mary would not like to testify.
Oh, I'm sorry. I I hadn't looked at the right side. Thank you. And I don't, is there anyone in Delta that wants to testify?
PR, do you want to?
Not really at this time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
We'll go to Michael Black in Anchorage, the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Are you on there?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, thank you, Michael. Would you go ahead and identify yourself and who you're representing, and go ahead with your testimony?
Yes, my name is Michael Black. I'm Director of the Division of Community Advocacy in the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And we are on record as not favoring this bill for substantially the same reasons that were brought up by the Local Boundary Commission testimony. And we feel that it would encumber their ability to perform under their job descriptions in the Constitution and regulations. So that is the general nature of our testimony.
Okay, and do you have any testimony on the amendment as you heard it read?
No, I do not at this time.
Okay, thank you. Anyone have any questions for Mr. Black? Seeing none, thank you very much. Let's go to Representative Coghill. Are you online, and do you wish to testify?
I'm here. I'm willing to testify, and I was a representative in the territorial legislature. I was a senator in the state legislature, and I retired as your lieutenant governor in the 90s. And I have, and I was also a member of the Constitutional Convention, and I was the chairman of the committee that ran the convention, and it was a great experience. My position is that the article in the Declaration of Rights, in the first article of our Constitution, is very clear that government, all government originates with the people, is found solely upon and instituted solely upon the good of the people as a whole. Now, some people will disagree with the fact that, well, maybe as a whole, then they have to have a mechanism within state government to allow larger groups to be able to gobble up smaller groups. And in your local boundary commission's authority, it establishes that basically the legislature, you folks are really the defenders of our Constitution to make sure that government structure does not override the will of the people. And on that basis, I have taken the position, and I've taken the position for many, many years, that the government structure has to have a legislative approval or vote of the people in order to be able to push people within a government.
We're back on record in House State Affairs. We have before us House Bill 238. You should have a sectional of the bill as well as the bill itself that we've been working with. I think what we will do is go online and take some testimony. There may be testimony here first. We are waiting for the Division of Retirement Benefits to come down to talk about the medical program section of the original tier committee, as well as the structure of House Bill 238. And so let's go first to Bill Bjork. Are you online in Anchorage? Lori, do we have Bill Bjork?
Huh? Can you hear me, Representative Seaton?
Oh, we can. Yes. Would you please go ahead and identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Seaton, and members of the House State Affairs Committee. For the record, my name is Bill Bjork. I'm the president of NEA Alaska. We represent 12,500 public school employees across the great state. Representative Seaton, I've submitted written testimony. You should have copies of that on our letterhead.
We do, Bill. I appreciate that submission of testimony.
And in the interest of time, sir, I will not read the testimony, but I would like to highlight some key points, if I may.
We appreciate that. Yes, go ahead.
You know, as we examine the retirement issues, it's important to remember the purpose of the retirement system, as stated in Alaska Law Section 14.25.012, which is to encourage qualified teachers to enter and remain in service with participating employers. Although there's some anecdotal evidence that retirement benefits can be used for recruitment, its main attraction is a tool for retaining educators. Job satisfaction, competitive compensation, and retirement benefits are the three major reasons for a person to remain in education. Today, I'd like to take some time to talk about the purpose of a retirement system and also some of the key assumptions we make going into this deliberation over changes in the retirement system. When a person considers retirement benefits, they want to be able to retire with dignity and to maintain their dignity through their retirement years. What does this mean is a key question. And in my written testimony, I've outlined some of that information for you. Currently, it takes about 27 years, which is the average number of years of a retired teacher from the teacher retirement system currently. Assumption number one, I would submit, and an educator with 27 years of service ought to be able to receive an annual annuity of at least 55% of their salary at retirement to be able to retire with dignity. I provided also in my written testimony some numbers about the average salary and what that represents as a percentage. You know, under House Bill 238, a person would need to work for at least 30 years. And that is three more years than the current average for our retired members at this time. Assumption number two is the level of investment return. We agree with the assumption currently in the retirement systems of 8.25%. It's the same assumption presently in place, and it's consistent with permanent fund assumptions as well. Assumption number three, the combined contribution of the employee and employer to the pension must be at least 20% of salary to accomplish what we've outlined above. Assumption number four regards inflation. The present actuarial assumption is 3.5% annually. This is not consistent with permanent fund assumptions. Given that inflation has been 2.6% over any 10-year period in Alaska, why would we adopt a 3.5% inflation rate? And that half a percent over 25 years adds a huge amount of money to the past service costs that you're considering now. Assumptions are critical in determining the necessity of a new and improved retirement system. Making the wrong assumptions today will only lead to retirees having no dignity and becoming dependent on the state of Alaska for welfare. We must take time to reach agreement on the actuarial assumptions to be used. I believe that there is agreement that the actuarial assumptions made in the past have brought us to this point, particularly in the area of health care. The delayed use of mortality rates and the addition of benefits in the retirement system without a corresponding increase in contributions are three of the major factors. At least two of these factors can be corrected without the adoption of a new tier for TERS and PERS. The use of most recent mortality tables could be mandated by the legislature. The legislature could also require an actuarial valuation of any proposed benefit increases or changes and require an increased contribution to cover past service costs at the time of passage. For example, if the retired rehired legislation is recommended for passage, the legislature could set a contribution rate for that benefit, which would be paid by the governmental entity that takes advantage of the legislation. NEA Alaska also believes that health care costs can be managed to provide a more predictable rate increase. It seems that the health cost trend actuarial assumptions provided to the administration June 30, 2002, absolutely defied common sense or logic. The projections provided on June 30, 2002, as printed in the retirement booklet, were increases in health care of 7.5% for fiscal 1, fiscal 2, 6.5%, fiscal 3, 5.5%, and fiscal 4 through 8, 5%, and it declines after that. Anyone using health care services could tell you that those rate projections were not based in reality. In fact, the very next year, printed in the very next book, the assumptions were changed to be fiscal 4, 12%, fiscal 5, 12%, fiscal 6, 11.5%, declining until fiscal 17, the increases would only be 5%. These numbers, when graphed, would make a pretty downhill slope, but are they based in reality? How could such a drastic change occur in 1 year? This kind of dramatic change does not inspire credibility in the actuary. Is this the kind of assumption that the $5 billion unfunded liability is based upon? NEA Alaska appreciates the efforts of House Bill 238 to provide important access to health care and payment of premiums for retirees. Once we all agree on the health care inflation assumptions to be used, we can evaluate the proposal and its impact on retirees' standard of living. For the record, a teacher that begins her career at age 22 and works for 30 years, as outlined in House Bill 238, without interruption, will be 52 when they could retire. That is three more years than the present average of years of service for current retirees. Since they must retire directly into the system under House Bill 238, they would actually have to teach for 38 years to reach age 60 or pay for their health care for 8 years, which would erode their pension annuities significantly. Again, the actual effect can only be determined once the actuarial assumptions are finalized. NEA Alaska believes that several things could be done to provide new and improved retirement system for both teachers and public employees. The key is, what assumptions are we going to put in place and agree upon? NEA Alaska stands ready to work with the committee to determine the appropriate actuarial assumptions upon which a new retirement system could be built that meets the purpose of recruiting and retaining qualified educators and public employees. Thank you, Representative Seaton, and the committee for your consideration today.
I appreciate your testimony here. It's focusing quite a bit on some of the things that we're dealing with as well. And Representative Lynn has a question for you here.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Bjork, for coming in to testify today. I think earlier you said that we need to mandate more recent actuarial tables. Yet the other day, somebody testified, stated that the mortality schedules come out, I think it was every 10 years. And please educate me on it. I would assume that actuarial tables are tied very closely to the mortality schedule. And the mortality schedule comes out only every 10 years. How would that work? Would we just project the actuarial table based upon presumed changes in the mortality schedule?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, you raise an excellent point, Representative Lynn. We just believe that we ought to implement the most recent actuarial table that is available. The mortality table, as you correctly point out, is a key driver of costs. If we change from one mortality table to a new mortality table and it shows increased longevity, then the actuarial assumptions trigger a huge past service increase. So you're absolutely right. When these are published, though, we ought to be using them. But in the actuarial assumption that is a particular problem, and I tried to highlight in my testimony today, is the increase in medical coverage cost. Those projections, as I outlined in that testimony, were just simply not real-world based. To say that at some point in the magic future, medical cost increases would only be 4% just simply isn't reflecting the kind of reality that all of us experience when we need medical coverage.
Thank you. Representative Lynn has a follow-up.
So as I understand it, the health cost is a bigger driver of the problem than the actual actuarial tables. Am I correct, or did I get that confused?
Yeah, actually, Representative Lynn, the two systems are different. It is the largest driver in the TERS system.
Right.
Accounting for about 40% of the past service costs, unfunded past service costs, but it's much less in the PERS system. So we have a difference in these two systems. They contributed at different rates, and they are the two system, the TERS system, currently has a large actuarial health care because the current employees qualify for medical at either 20 years or the newer tier at 25 years, and in PERS, you qualify after 30 years of employment or age 60, whichever comes first. So the difference is that, and that there's been a proposal, you know, for firefighters and all
right,
to have them qualify at an earlier age as well. And so we can look at the medical component comparison between the different tiers and the different programs. In a few minutes, we can pull that up.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner, did you have a question?
Yes.
Oh, okay. One thing, Ms. Bjork, I had a question. The average teacher is now retired out of the system, I mean out of active service at 27 years. The different RIP programs, early retirement, retirement incentive programs, do you have an analysis at all on how much those retirement incentive programs lowered the retirement age and how much of that three-year gap between the 30 that 238 calls for and the 27, which is your average coming out of the system, how much of that you think would be accounted for by the different RIP programs that went forward?
Representative Seaton, what an interesting question. You know, you raise the issue of the RIPs, the retirement incentive programs, whether they be a state offered RIP or a local retirement incentive programs, because both were offered. It's hard to quantify and to answer your question directly because only a small number of the total retirees actually got access to those RIPs. So it's hard to spread that number across the retired population, give you a straight up answer on that, sir.
Sure, and I understand it could be difficult, and I just wanted to know if you did have that information, it would be helpful.
Right. Representative Seaton, you know, the history before, prior to the RIPs is also illustrative in that about 27 years of active service is the average for those retirees, not factoring any RIP whatsoever.
Okay, thank you very much. Do we have other questions? I mean, there are questions that we're going to have to be asking that you've highlighted here that are very good. One thing I would like to look at is assumption number three that you have on page one there about that it would pension must be, the contribution must be 20%. And for TERS, the current version of House Bill 238 has 22%. So does that fit within your range of expectation for a plan that would provide those equality of benefits?
Representative Seaton, I appreciate the question, sir. It's our experience that 20% of salary needs to go towards the pension. You do correctly point out those numbers within House Bill 238, although a chunk of that goes towards major medical coverage and also the health reimbursement arrangement. So those percentages are not going directly into the pension. It is our experience with our own employees that it takes about 20% of salary into the pension to accomplish retirement with dignity, sir.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is if we look back at the normal cost rate assumptions that have been taking place over the past number of years, it averaged 11.16 for that's since 1980 through 2003 for the employer section, and you had 8% for the employee, so you had less than 20% total, including the medical currently, and I'm trying to figure out where the 20% into the retirement plus medical come from, if that hasn't been the history in any of the last 20 years in the current program.
Well, I absolutely agree with the numbers you've put forward, Representative Seaton. That is our experience, that it takes 20% of salary to accomplish a defined benefit program, a defined contribution program that would allow an annuity of sufficient size to last a person throughout their retirement years.
Oh, okay. Thank you. That's a good clarification. I appreciate that. And so that you're talking about the amount that would be necessary in a defined contribution, and you're probably factoring in. Are you factoring in that at least at the 8.25%, or are you factoring a lower percentage investment rate based on history of defined contribution programs, 401ks versus defined benefit program?
Representative Seaton, we are factoring in an 8.25, as you correctly asserted.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Does anyone else have any further questions? And we appreciate your written testimony. It will allow us to identify these issues a lot better. Willie Dunn, are you online?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we sure can, Willie. Would you identify yourself, who you represent, and go ahead with your testimony?
Sure. My name is Willie Dunn. I live in Fritz Creek, and I'm president of the Kachemak Bay chapter of the Alaska State Employees Association. We have about 60 state employee members in the Kachemak Bay Homer area. I also sent in some testimony, much more general testimony that I hope you all have a copy of there. I just sent it in on behalf of myself.
Yeah, Willie, just to let you know, we do all have that in front of us.
Okay, great. And as I said, you know, I haven't looked at the nuts and bolts of this, and you've heard some good testimony already on some of the specifics of it, but the members of our chapter are very concerned about any impact to our increase to our current contributions. Basically, we haven't seen a pay increase in a couple of years. We're due for a very small increase this year. And if we had to increase the percentage of our earnings towards retirement, we would basically lose any increase that we might be seeing from our contract negotiations. You know, state employees, the ones that I work with, are very hardworking, very dedicated. Most of them are doing it because it's a job they want to do, and they really enjoy doing that job. They're not doing it necessarily for the money, because they could make more money in the private sector, and especially with the federal government. And it seems like we're losing a lot of our long-term employees to the private sector and the federal government. And like you heard earlier, you know, the retirement benefits is one of the things that keeps public employees, especially state employees that I work with, keeps us going. because we see people around us making a lot more money, and I know a number of folks have jumped over to work for the federal government, and they increase their salary significantly by doing so. But the fact that, we know we're in it for the long run, and we want to do a good job and work hard and know that we'll have, a decent retirement when we get to that point is one of the things that keeps us employed. So I just hope you would, consider very carefully any changes to the contributions that current employees make, and also think very carefully about how you might structure a new tier. I believe that would negatively impact recruitment. We have a hard time finding qualified employees as it is right now because the salary is not competitive with the federal government and with the private sector. So a new tier and a less desirable retirement plan would affect recruitment even more. And so I understand that there's a big $5 billion problem out there that has to be dealt with. But I think to start this discussion, you should be very careful about hurting current employees anymore. We're already kind of losing our buying power. One study that I read showed that state employees have lost about a 30% buying power in their wages over the past 25 years. It has not kept up with inflation, and any further reduction would cause employees to think about jumping ship and not sticking it out. So thank you very much. I know Representative Seaton and your staff have put a lot of work into this, and I appreciate that, but I also want you to think very carefully about harming current employees any more than we already have been. Thanks.
Thank you, Willie. Appreciate that. And I do want to make sure that everybody separates in their minds the two segments of the retirement program that's being considered. One is going to a defined contribution program, and no element of that program would change existing employees unless they were non-vested and opted to change from the current defined benefit tier 3 to the defined contribution tier 4 if they individually decided that was going to be better for them in the long run. So a defined contribution program is a new tier. It would not in itself affect any current employees in any way, except with that one caveat that if non-vested employees wanted to convert, there was an option available. The sure. Other thing that I would like to, yes, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. In relation to that, is it also true to say that going to a defined contribution plan with a new tier now would not in any way affect the shortfall? It's only dealing with future issues. That's
correct. For everybody's information, the way the the past service cost is generated, you look at the projected payments that we as a state and the school districts, municipalities, anybody that's an employer under the plan, what those projected expenditures are going to have to be amortized over the next 25 years. Mm-hmm. And so what you look at is what are the benefits that are projected to be accrued by employees. And then you have that expense, and then you know how much money you have in the bank, and you can project that growing at 8.25%. And how many of those expenses do we have covered? Mm-hmm. And so the truth is that if you look at the payments that will have to be made, it's $15.6 billion. In the 2003 numbers, and you have some charts in there that show that. It's only if you talk about present dollar cost. In other words, if you take those costs and back calculate, subtracting 8.25% interest per year, do you come back to last 2003, it was a $5 billion present dollar cost that were underfunded. Again, we're assuming that there's that $5 billion in 2003 was put in the bank earning 8.25%, and that $5 billion would have covered the future past service cost. Mm-hmm. We didn't do that in 2003. The 2004 numbers basically escalate by 8.25% because we have one less year to grow that amount. So now it's $5.6 billion is the present dollar cost that we would need to have invested at 8.25 to cover the projected liabilities of $15.6 billion. If we don't do something with present dollars this year, what happens is that $5.6 billion is going to grow by 8.25%, so that the $15.6 billion of projected costs are still going to be the same, but we just don't have as many years to invest some money now to grow to cover it.
Right.
And that, it's a little misleading, just to so that everybody understands. You have two ways or a combination of covering this. One is you have cash we could put in right now. We could put in $5.6 billion this year in, let it grow at 8.25. It covers every bit of the past service cost. There would be no increase in employer contribution rates to cover the past service cost, because we would cover it with cash out of the general fund, let's say. The other way you can do it is, as the tables that we've looked at, contribution rates by employers going up to 44% for TERS in a few years, so that 44% of the salaries of every teacher in the state would have to be an additional 44% mm-hmm. would have to be put into their retirement account over those next 25 years. That would cover 100% of the past service cost. Or we could be looking at a combination, taking some money up front, putting it in to cover part of that, and having increased employer contribution rates or employer and employee matching somewhat contribution rates to cover that past service cost. But those calculations are all based on the employer rates at 44% are talking about the total salary of all of the school districts. So since it is calculated on the total salary base growing at 1% per year of the population, that means that even if we do a defined contribution plan and there is no actual past service cost associated with that individual employee, the employer is still going to have to pay the same amount of money, because the calculations of those rates are based upon their total salary of the employer. So it gets very confusing, because it is a past service cost liability to the employer, though there, if we do a defined contribution program, there to each individual new employee, there is no identified past service cost. But the whole what happens is, just to back up and take one more moment on this, is if you don't include the new defined contribution wage base of the new employees, then what happens is, instead of being at 44%, as soon as you have an equal number of new employees and older employees, then that contribution rate would be 88%.
On fewer employees.
And so that's where this, the actuarials have come and said, to make a rate that is reasonably fixed over time, amortized by rate over time, they have to use the entire wage base. Because if they only use the declining wage base, pretty soon you'd have, you know, 200 or 300 employees left that hadn't retired yet, and you'd be paying 10,000% of their salary, because you still have to maintain that same dollar amount of payment, and you wouldn't be spreading it over the wage base. Does that make anybody have any questions on that? Make sense to everybody? Yeah, Representative Groomer.
Not on that. I have a question for Mr. Doug.
Yeah, Willie, Representative Groomberg has a question for you.
Sure.
You mentioned a minute ago that you had seen a study that over the last 25 years, the earning power of governmental employees had declined 30%. Do you recall that testimony?
Yes, I do.
Could you lay your hands on that study?
I believe that was part of the public safety employees negotiations. And it was, I believe it was conducted by David Realm. I don't have it in front of me, but I could probably locate that for you.
I would be very grateful. Have you seen that?
We would sure like to get it here at the committee.
Okay. Could you, maybe you could, somebody could give him the telephone number or something if you get that too.
Sure. And Willie, you've got my my number and fax number there, or email address. Can you, if you can find that, would you get it to the committee?
Certainly. I'll try and find that today if I can.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Willie.
Willie, the other thing that I did want to mention is that there are three things, you know, you were testifying about existing tiers. There's three things that change in 238, and one of them is a preferred drug list, generic drugs or preferred provider drug list would be required under existing employees. Changing the definition of the ad hoc post-retirement pension adjustments so that those would be paid. Right now it just says when the system can afford it, and we would be changing the definition so that when the system can support it means when it's 100% funded. And the third thing was equalizing contributions between employers and employees, and you testified to that, and we'll be considering that in great detail. So appreciate your testimony there.
Great. Thank you for the opportunity.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Willie. Did you have a...
That's sort of, that's from you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Apparently there was an ADN article on that, and we'll see if we can get that for the committee as well. Let's see. Do we don't have retirement benefits here yet for us. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on House Bill 238?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Just in case anybody else had a question, Representative Elkins had a question about one of the sections in 238. Are we going to be walking through that bill at some point?
Yes, we will.
Okay. The question, just for people who don't know, they mentioned what's called a Qualified Domestic Relations Order, a QUADRO, as we call it. It's used in family law. It's a court order dividing a pension in a divorce. And I can get you all kinds of information. It's used all over the statutes.
Would you repeat
anybody else?
That, please? Through the chair, would you repeat the acronym and what it stands for?
Qualified Domestic Relations Order, QDRO. Some people call them QDROs, other people call them QUADROs. But they are required under federal law and state law to meet the requirements of these statutes and ERISA, the Employment Retirement Income Security Act. They are called, in military, they have similar things for military, they're called COPES, Court Orders Acceptable for Processing, but they're the same thing.
Thank you.
And you'll notice in, as you go through, there's two different terms that are used here, one's member and one's participant, and the reason those there's two different terms is a member is someone that contributed into as an employee and is a retiree, let's say, whether it doesn't matter on which program you are. And a participant can be if the member died and their children or spouse or someone under that's divorced and there's this separation order so that each owns half of the retirement fund, and so that's the difference in this bill between participant and member.
And those are absolutely terms of art. They're known throughout the industry.
Is there anyone else online to testify? We'll take just a brief at ease.